Today on Wings, a starter course in caring economics, as analyzed and taught by Rhianne Eisler's Center for Partnership Studies.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Capitalism's traditional economic measures count only exchange in the marketplace. They do not value work done in the family, in the community, or in the natural world. Work done by women and men who work as caregivers, often in addition to a job in the market economy. In fact, taking time off the job to care for a sick child is called lost productivity, while building yet another bomb that kills many children is considered productive work.
When we look at what indicators give us a more accurate picture of our real wealth, the Center for Partnership Studies has been engaging this question for many years and has developed two primary sets of social wealth economic indicators.
Sarah Saltee, Director of Leadership and Learning Programs for the Center for Partnership Studies.
The first set are what we are calling human capacity indicators, which are measures of the degree of human capacity development, including the development of our capacities for caring and creativity, both individually and in families and in groups and organizations. So human capacity indicators pay special attention to social equity, keeping in mind studies showing that addressing inequity makes for a more productive, harmonious, and healthy society. The second set of indicators are what we call care investment indicators, and these measure our national investment in caring for people in ways that promote their optimal development and meet both their human needs and our nation's need for success in the post-industrial knowledge service age.
The Center for Partnership Studies, which uses the slogan, "Building Our Future Together," presents courses and metrics that link the value of caregiving to overall economic prosperity. According to its website, the center's mission is to accelerate movement to partnership systems of human rights and nonviolence, gender and racial equity, economic prosperity, and a sustainable environment through research, education, grassroots empowerment, and policy initiatives that promote human development, social well-being, and long-term economic success, with special emphasis on valuing the work of caring and caregiving still primarily done by women. I'm Kellya Romaris Watson. I had an opportunity to participate in one of their webinars, this one called The Caring Economy Starter Course. Though what you will hear now is only about half of the course, it should be enough to get you thinking about the economic value of human and environmental care.
Many of you are really working hard already to raise the visibility and value of the work of care. We think you'll find that the caring economy framework powerfully supports all of our efforts by offering a foundation of evidence that reducing poverty and investing in people is essential not only in human terms, but also in terms of our collective economic success. My name is Sarah Saltee. I'm the director of the Caring Economy Advocates Program and the Leadership and Learning Programs at the Center for Partnership Studies. We want to begin today by sharing with you some striking black and white portraits of American women, along with some striking facts and figures about where we are today in the United States with respect to gender and poverty. These images and facts are drawn from last year's Shriver Report, subtitled "A Woman's Nation Pushes Back from the Brink." We know that one in three women in America are living in poverty or teetering on its brink. That's 42 million women plus the 28 million children who depend on them. Today, only one in five families in the United States has a homemaker mom and working dad. Two out of three families depend on the wages of working moms who are struggling to balance caregiving and breadwinning. We also know that women are nearly two-thirds of minimum wage workers in this country, and a vast majority of these workers receive no paid sick days, not one. These statistics reveal that we've been operating as if care and caregiving work have no economic value, as if the work of taking care of children, elders, and other members of our communities is completely separate from the, quote, economically productive work that happens in workplaces. We cannot achieve real prosperity until we make this critical missing connection. And so the Caring Economy campaign is part of a national and international movement to make the connection between care and prosperity, which is a first step to changing these statistics, improving the lives of women and families, and enhancing our overall collective economic success. So before we introduce the Caring Economy framework, let me share with you just a little bit about how the Caring Economy campaign is structured. The campaign is a project of the Center for Partnership Studies, and it has three mutually supporting areas for action. The first is public policy work, where we're primarily focused on the development of social wealth economic indicators, which we'll be introducing in greater depth a little bit later. These are measures of real economic health designed to be an alternative to the gross domestic product. Second, we have leadership and learning programs through which we are training leaders in the caring economy movement. And third, coalition building. We're creating and leveraging connections between individuals and organizations with a shared interest in creating the caring economy we so urgently need. So let's begin our exploration of the caring economy framework by making sense of this pairing of two words that we're just not used to hearing together, caring and economy. At the heart of the Caring Economy campaign is a simple equation that until now has been generally ignored, that care equals prosperity. The Caring Economy campaign provides the evidence that caring is not only important in human terms, but also in financial terms. Caring pays in dollars and cents. To understand how and why this is true, let's first look at the full meaning of the word prosperity. I want to invite you to just take a moment and picture in your own mind those things that bring you the greatest fulfillment, happiness, well-being. What is it that really adds value to your life? What is it that brings your life a sense of richness? What kinds of things for you bring you the most fulfillment, happiness, well-being, the greatest sense of value, the greatest sense of richness in your own life experience? What are those things for you? Well, one of the things that happens in our community advocates program is that we have leaders around the world that we provide with a toolkit that includes discussion activities and group activities like this one. And when this question has been asked by our advocates all around the world, the answers are really similar, which is to say that all around the world we know that when we think about our lived experience of wealth, almost no one raises issues around material wealth. What we do hear about over and over again are aspects of social wealth, in other words, our relationships, the quality of our relationships with our families and our communities, and natural relationships, the quality of our relationship to the natural world and the quality of our environment itself. So we know then from our lived experience that real wealth or true prosperity really only exists when all three kinds of wealth are sustainable and vibrant. In her book, The Real Wealth of Nations, Rian Eisler shows that once we understand this, that our real wealth consists not just of things or even primarily of things, but of our connections to people and to our planet, then we can ask a powerful new question. What kind of an economy then grows real wealth? What kind of an economy gives value to the activities that most support and advance human survival and human development? What kind of an economy expands our social and natural wealth, and in so doing, creates sustainable prosperity as well? The first step to answering that question is to recognize that it is the work of care and caregiving that happens in households, in our communities, and in our natural environment that grows our real wealth. Now, this link between care and prosperity has been invisible within the economic categories we've inherited. In fact, our old economic models did not see caring for people as productive work. These economic models, of course, emerged in an outdated historical context in which anything associated with women or, quote, women's work was devalued. In that cultural context, key economic thinkers like Marx and Smith and many others defined the work of care as reproductive labor, not productive labor, thus making the foundational economic contributions of household work invisible. But times have changed. Today, we know that caring is a human value, not a gendered value, and the work of care, whether performed by women or men, is the critical foundation of a healthy economy and vibrant communities. The economic map that we've been using, however, has not caught up with our new realities. It still includes only those goods and services that change hands in the market economy and excludes three foundational economic sectors which determine our real wealth: the household sector, the unpaid community sector, and the natural economy. To create an economy that grows our real wealth, we need a new economic map, a full-spectrum map of the economy that includes the essential life-giving work of care. So with this new map in hand, let's take a look next at three key components of a caring economy and really ask ourselves, what does a caring economy really look like? The first key is a caring economy is created through policies that provide meaningful supports to the women and men who do the work of care, both in the marketplace and in non-market economic sectors. What kinds of policies are we talking about? Policies that recognize and honor the value of the work of care, like parental leave, paid sick days, paid family and medical leave, flexible work options, workplace child care and wellness programs. When we look at where we are today in the United States with respect to this first key, let's just focus in for a moment on sick leave policies and take a look at just three data points that begin to paint the picture of why policies that acknowledge the value of care work are so urgently needed. According to a recent AARP report, 42 million adults in this country are providing unpaid care work for friends or family members. Two-thirds of these caregivers are women, and the average family caregiver is 49 years old, female, works outside the home, and spends about 20 hours a week in unpaid care work. We know that this care work can be quantified in value and that all that care work is a powerful but invisible economic boon to our country. In 2009, for example, adults in the baby boomer generation alone contributed the equivalent of an estimated $450 billion in unpaid care work. This is more than the Medicaid budget and almost as much as our nation's Medicare budget. As this generation ages, however, this pool of caregivers is shrinking rapidly, as boomers had on average smaller family sizes than prior generations. Yet our policies that support the people who do care work are woefully inadequate. Remember that the average caregiver is a woman who works outside the home in addition to her caregiving duties? Well, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 38% of private sector workers and 75% of part-time workers lack even one paid sick day per year in this country. How does this compare to the rest of the world? Well, with respect to policies that support care, if we shift our gaze for just a moment to maternity leave, another key policy designed to support caregivers of infants and children, It is important to say that not all of these countries implement these laws fully, but at least they're on the books. In fact, out of 178 nations in the world, only three do not legally guarantee mothers paid leave: the United States, Papua New Guinea, and Swaziland. 50 nations also offer paid leave for fathers. So why is now the time to advocate for policies that support caregivers? Well, what smart businesses and countries around the world have discovered is that we see significant returns on investment when such policies are in place. Here are just a few specific examples of the return on investment of caring policies experienced by a few major international companies. What becomes clear is that when businesses acknowledge the human needs of their employees, who must care for themselves, their children, and their families, even while they perform their jobs, they see significant and sometimes dramatic returns on their investments that take the form of reduced turnover, reduced recruiting, hiring, and training costs, increased loyalty, lower absenteeism, reduced stress, and higher productivity. This brings us now to the second key component of a caring economy: investment in high-quality early childhood experiences at home and in school. Here we're talking about investments in accessible, high-quality childcare, subsidies for childcare, training requirements for early childcare workers, and parenting programs. When we look at why this proposal is so needed, there are just a few other data points that might give you a flavor of how urgently we need the investment in affordable, quality early childhood education. The annual cost of childcare for an infant in a childcare center is higher than a year's tuition at the average four-year public college in most U.S. states. We also know that families making less than $1,500 per month spend more than half their income on childcare. The good news is that nearly 80% of all Americans say the government should expand access to high-quality, affordable childcare. When we look at where other nations are with respect to policies that invest in early childhood, we want to just direct our attention briefly to a group of nations that today regularly ranks highly, not only in the World Economic Forum's global competitiveness reports, but also, of course, on humanistic measures: Nordic countries such as Sweden, Norway, and Finland. At the beginning of the 20th century, these nations were so poor that people fled famines there in droves. Indeed, whole American states like Minnesota were populated by these economic refugees. Today, these countries have very low poverty rates, long lifespans, students who score high on international educational tests, low crime rates, and a generally good quality of life for all. So what changed? Well, a major factor is that they started to really invest in caring for their people. Nordic nations have government-supported childcare, universal health care, stipends to help families care for children, social security credits for the first 7 years of caring for a child at home, whether by a woman or a man, elder care with dignity, generous paid parental leave for both mothers and fathers. These are policies we must have as well, so we can realistically talk about balancing life and work for mothers and fathers. So why is now the time? Well, we are experiencing, living through, an economic transformation to a new economic era, an information service economy which requires different kinds of workers than were required in prior economic ages like the agrarian age or industrial age. The information service economy is driven by flexible, creative, and empathetic people. It's people with these capacities that are what economists call high-quality human capital. And now more than ever, it is this high-quality human capital which determines our economic success. When we look at what we know about how high-quality human capital is created, today's neuroscience shows that early childhood is the critical period for the development of these capacities, and that these capacities are developed largely through a child's relationships with primary caregivers. So in a very direct way, and in this economic era more than ever, investments in high-quality early childhood experiences at home and in school are the foundation of economic success. Yet opposition to public funding for such programs remains fierce in some corners of the United States. The loudest complaint is that public programs have not been shown to be cost-effective. But a wealth of research by highly respected economists shows that well-designed, high-quality early childhood education programs actually offer a very positive payback. And when we look at how investments in education save on other social costs over time, the picture is even clearer. A recent U.S. longitudinal study shows a return to society of more than $17 for every $1 invested in early care and education programs. Other research demonstrates that children who have access to quality early childhood education programs earn $143,000 more over their lifetimes than children who did not receive those benefits. Dollars spent on education for young children are far more effective than dollars spent at any other time in a person's life. This brings us to the third key. New measures of economic health that, unlike the GDP, take into account the full spectrum of economic activity, including those activities which contribute most to the well-being of humans and our planet Earth. Why are new measures so critical? Well, measures really become the frame within which policy is made and tested. We grow what we measure. And if we intend to grow our real wealth, we must adopt measures that help make our real wealth visible. When we look at the measures in use today, we see that in this country and around the world, we still rely heavily on the gross domestic product, or GDP, a measure that was never intended to be a primary or sole indicator of economic health, to tell us about our health and comparative standing in the world. GDP is a deeply flawed number that gives absolutely no economic value to the activities that actually contribute the most to human well-being, the life-sustaining activities of the household economy, the volunteer community economy, and the natural economy. So an old stand of trees is only included in GDP when it's chopped down. The fact that we need trees to breathe is ignored. Similarly, the caring and caregiving work performed in households is given no value whatsoever. By contrast, the GDP does include activities that harm and even take life. So making cigarettes and the associated medical bills, legal bills, funeral bills are great for GDP. Oil spills are also marvelous for GDP, involving huge cleanup costs, lawsuits, etc. So why is now the time to develop social wealth economic indicators? Well, for one thing, we can no longer complain that it's just too difficult to quantify the value of care work in economic terms. New data from around the world, for example, shows that unpaid household work is worth 30 to 50% of GDP. We also now know that the status of women and children are key predictors of both long-term quality of life and economic success. Studies like a Center for Partnership Studies report called Women, Men, and the Global Quality of Life show that the status of women can be a better predictor of the quality of life for everyone in a society than GDP. And this has been confirmed ever since by other reports, such as the World Economic Forum's Gender Gap reports. In other words, GDP is a measure that's limited to the old economic map, the one that left out key sectors of the economy. And a caring economy requires measures that help us see and manage all parts of the real economic map. We call these measures social wealth economic indicators. When we look at what these indicators are, that give us a more accurate picture of our real wealth, the Center for Partnership Studies has been engaging this question for many years and has developed two primary sets of social wealth economic indicators. The first set are what we are calling human capacity indicators, which are measures of the degree of human capacity development, including the development of our capacities for caring and creativity, both individually and in families and in groups and organizations. So human capacity indicators pay special attention to social equity, keeping in mind studies showing that addressing inequity makes for a more productive, harmonious, and healthy society. The second set of indicators are what we call care investment indicators, and these measure our national investment in caring for people in ways that promote their optimal development and meet both their human needs and our nation's need for success in the post-industrial knowledge service age. Two ways that you can take action for a caring economy. The first way is to join the Caring Economy Coalition. You can become a member on behalf of your organization or as an individual. Just go to the Coalition tab on the main menu of caringeconomy.org, the website, and you'll find a quick and easy form to complete to become a member. And on every page of the new website, you can include your information to subscribe to receive our newsletter and other updates from our campaign. A second way that you can participate in the Caring Economy movement is to become a certified Caring Economy Community Advocate. Our Community Advocates Program is an online leadership program. Participants complete a practicum where they go into their communities and host a first Caring Economy conversation. It's 5 online sessions, meet with very small cohort groups that allow you to really dig in and practice using the language of Caring Economy and a whole array of tools that we've created to support you in sharing the Caring Economy message with others in your community, in your workplace, through the work that you're already doing in the world.
You have been listening to Sarah Saltee, Director of Leadership and Learning Programs for the Center for Partnership Studies. She presented the Caring Economy Starter Course, a 1-hour webinar on efforts to gain greater recognition for caregivers and caring work in statistics, in public and private sector business policy, and in wages and benefits. WINGS thanks the Center for Partnership Studies and the Caring Economy Campaign for permission to rebroadcast their webinar material. The website for the Center for Partnership Studies is partnershipway.org. The website for the Caring Economy Campaign is caringeconomy.org. For WINGS, I'm Kelia Ramirez Watson in Berkeley, California.
To hear this or other WINGS programs again, email wings@wings.org. And please like our daily news feed at facebook.com/WINGS Radio. WINGS thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station. Please give generously to your station at pledge time and tell them you like WINGS. Special thanks to Suzette Cullen and to Genevieve Vaughn, author of many books and articles on the gift economy, including Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The WINGS sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.